The following Dharma talk was done by Lawrence Doan Greco at Open Sky Zen in New York City. For more information about Open Sky, please visit www.openskyzen.com.
But it's pretty good. It's good to sit with you all. Yeah, it is a balancing act between, you know, thoughts blurring with dreams and getting tired and then being awake again and feeling out of sync, right? Do you remember what it was like riding a bicycle? I had a bicycle with training wheels for quite some time. And then one day, my father just took an entire Saturday afternoon and he helped me learn how to ride a two-wheel bike without the training wheels. He took them off, and it just took hours and hours and hours. And there was something just seemed to click where I stopped worrying so much about the technique of it and thinking to death about it, and then I was able to just do it. And I got it. Anyone relate to an experience like that? Whether it's learning to ride a bike or anything else? I sometimes think, you know, even a caterpillar, if they considered what they were really doing and how many feet are involved, if they're walking from here to there, they would probably just fall over. But they don't think so much, they just do it, right? Naturally. But sometimes the more we think about something, the stranger it becomes and the more separate from us it becomes. And then all of a sudden we stumble. I've even done this with certain words, like I've spelled a million times, but when I look at it, all of a sudden it looks funny. I'm like, no, that can't be the way you spelled that. Is that the way you spell it? But actually, no, it is. I was just thinking it to death, and all of a sudden it looks strange instead of just spelling it. It's funny because our thoughts are so rampant and so random and so unrelenting, that they obscure our true nature. So it's like we're in this physical body with this job to do. And it sounds so strange. So one of the things that can help us realize who and what we really are is something that every fiber of our being seems to resist, and that's meditation. It's really one of the best things a person can do and one of the most challenging things to work into your life. At least at first, until it becomes more habit. Or over time, it becomes something you can look forward to. That's why I encourage comfort. Make sure you're feeling okay when you're sitting so that you don't dread the experience every time you do it. So we talk a lot about our true nature in Zen. Right? What is our true nature? What is that supposed to mean? A few months ago, I was giving a talk about this subject, just about what does it mean to discover our true nature? And I thought it was a pretty good talk. And at the very end, you know, there are all kinds of questions. It was a very academic crowd. And a very young man, after everything he heard and said, and we had sat together for half an hour, all of it, he raised his hands, I just can't conceive of having a true nature. I just can't even begin to conceive of it. So I said, actually, neither can I, and that's a good thing. And he didn't like that answer. But it was really the only honest answer I could give him. I want to tell you a story about hundreds of years ago, there was this sutra master. You know, sutras are like Buddhist lessons or like the Diamond Sutra, the Heart Sutra. So there was this great sutra master named Dokson. And his whole thing was he knew the Diamond Sutra inside out. He could quote verses from it. You could ask him anything about the deeper hidden meanings of the Diamond Sutra and he could tell you. And he really kind of got off on quizzing people about it. So he would go from temple to temple and pull out his copy of the Diamond Sutra. And he had written many commentaries, so he had all of his papers with him with his commentaries and writings about the Diamond Sutra. And he would quiz the monks about it, thinking, I'm going to help them attain enlightenment. So if they understand the Buddhist teachings, if they understand the Diamond Sutra, they'll wake up and they'll discover their true nature. So he did this for years. Sometimes he would stump people, sometimes he would teach them. And no one could ever stump him with any questions with regard to the Diamond Sutra. So sometimes, like, has anyone ever read the Diamond Sutra? Are you familiar with it? You have? So some things, like, you'll read in there are, it's sort of like the Buddha's talking to someone named Subhuti. and the teaching style of the Buddha in the Diamond Sutra is to ask a lot of questions. So typically I'll say something like, what do you think, Subhuti? Are there many particles of dust in the vast universe? Questions like that. Very interesting, seemingly esoteric writing. So one day he heard about a Zen temple in the south of China where all the monks and nuns did was sit all day in meditation, eat, sleep, wake up, sit in meditation, eat, and they did no sutra study whatsoever, and they were quiet all the time. So he thought this was ridiculous. And he thought, I'm going to pack up all my commentaries and my copy of the Diamond Sutra, and I'm going to make this journey there. It was like a long journey by foot. It took him weeks to get there. And I'm going to test these monks, and I'm going to hit them with my stick if they can't answer my questions about the Diamond Sutra. So I'm going to wake them up, like I am. So he packed his bag, he made his way to southern China, and about a week later he finally got pretty close to the temple, and he saw this little old tea house. And he was greeted by a very old Buddhist laywoman who owned the tea house, and she brought him some tea, she brought him some food. She said, oh, I know that you're Dokusan, right? You're the great sutra master. So nice to meet you. And she said, what are you doing here? And he said, well, I'm going to that temple in your town where these people think all you have to do is sit and eat and sleep and realize their Buddha nature, and I'm going to tell them that they're wrong because I've got the Diamond Sutra with me and my commentaries, and I'm going to teach them a thing or two about Buddhism. So she said, ah, that's very, very interesting. It's wonderful that you understand the Buddha's teaching so much. So she said, but I have a question for you, actually. And if you could answer this question correctly, I'll give you your lunch for free. So he was offended, thinking, who the hell is this old lady asking me a question? Who does she think she is? So he said, all right, fine, ask me anything. Go ahead. So she said, in the Diamond Sutra, it says, it's impossible to keep past mind, it's impossible to hold on to present mind, and it's impossible to grasp future mind. So, Master Dokusan, with what mind will you eat lunch? And he just dropped his chopstick, dropped his cup, and he just sat there and he scratched his head wondering, what mind will I eat my lunch? And he couldn't answer. He was actually stumped. So he started running through his head like, wait a minute, was that the 28th chapter of the, wait a minute, where was that covered? And his mind was racing around wondering, what is she referring to? What is she asking me here? So he really, really was shocked and really, really humbled. So the old woman laughed and he said, you know what? This is really funny. You don't understand the Diamond Sutra's true meaning at all. You understand words, but you don't understand what it means. And how are you going to test these monks in that temple down the road? Who do you think you are? How are you going to teach them anything? So he looked at her, really humbled at this point, and said, how did you gain such profound understanding? Who did you study with? What did you do? And she said, I didn't get it from anywhere. That everyone already has it inside of themselves if they just would know to look. So needless to say, Dokusan scrapped his plans to go to the temple, and instead he had to go find himself a Zen master to train with. He realized, okay, I better start from scratch now. He wasn't as smart as he thought he was. So he went to this local Zen master, a very famous old woman, and he sat with her, and he explained his predicament. He said, you know, I'm a great sutra master, but I just met this woman in the tea house down the road, and she taught me that I don't know as much as I thought I did, and I need you to help me. And he started explaining to the Zen master everything he knew about the Diamond Sutra and emptiness and what is appearance and non-appearance and no coming and no going and all this blah, blah, blah stuff, you know, we've heard about here and there, varying degrees of understanding. So finally, it's like past midnight, and the Zen master looks at her watch, and she's like, all right, it's time for bed. It's getting kind of late now. Let's talk about this tomorrow. So she was going to let him sleep in this little house outside of the temple. But it was very dark by this time. And he left, and he said, oh, master, I can't see outside. Can you give me a candle or something? So she handed him a candle, and she lit it for him. And as he opened the door to go outside, it was pitch black. Right? The new moon, you could hardly see anything. At that moment, she blew out his candle, and he was stuck in complete darkness, couldn't see a thing, and then he attained enlightenment. In that 1 second, then he understood. So the next day, he stood side by side with the Zen master in front of all her students, all these monks and these nuns, and he said, I've learned a great lesson from this woman. And he said, I thought I could study my way to enlightenment, but now I understand all of that was useless. So I could no better study my way to understanding my true nature than I could fill a canyon with a single drop of water. And he took all of his commentaries and his copy of the Diamond Sutra, and he put a torch to them, and he lit them up on fire. A great story. So, Zen practice is simply about returning to your mind as it is before thinking arises. That's it. If anyone ever asks you, what does Zen mean? That's all. Zen was what you were just doing for half an hour with me a little while ago. Just sitting there and noticing thoughts come and go, and then breathing. So the thoughts themselves are what we confuse with who we are, because we identify with them and we buy into them and we believe them. But when we understand how transparent they are, how insubstantial and how random they are, like the experience you had, like sometimes you would hear things or, I don't know, it's incredible what the brain will come up with and throw at you. It really is random. So understanding that process of how our thoughts work is what helps us to not be ruled by them. And when we return to our mind as it naturally is, and our mind is naturally open and spacious and peaceful, then we're getting a glimpse of our true nature. And I bet you everyone here has had a moment of that here or there. Yeah. And that's all enlightenment is. Enlightenment is not a special, blissful state. Enlightenment doesn't make you the smartest person in the world all of a sudden. You know, in fact, sometimes the smarter you're not, the easier practice will be for you. Even, you know, koan practice, I learned being smart does not help you. If you work with a teacher doing koans, being smart doesn't do a thing for you. Actually, it could be a hindrance. Because the answers to koans, or these seemingly nonsensical questions, are not dependent on rational thinking. It's dependent on something else. And that something else can only arise from our mind, our true nature. This place of not knowing versus knowing, which we like to do. We like to know things. We like to know all about things. And that makes us feel comfortable and confident. But the more we think we know, the less room there is for wisdom. But the more we think we know, the less appropriately we can respond to whatever life brings our way. So understanding our true nature isn't something we can learn from a book or from a teacher. No more than, like if someone were hungry, it wouldn't make sense for me to show them a picture of a wonderful meal. Like, would that help their hunger? Right? Or to describe the best meal I ever had to a starving person? Like, oh, you should have been there. I had this wonderful salad with, you know, chickpeas and cranberries, and oh, it's delicious. Doesn't make sense. So when we come to life or come to practice with this thinking mind, right, trying to just read our way to enlightenment or to compassion or study our way there or ask questions to our way there, it's not going to really do it. But it's the sitting that does it. It's, you know, enlightenment is really just those moments where there's no more me and you. There's just what I'm doing right now. That's all. Just like when I learned to ride a bicycle, finally. It's when I was able to stop thinking so much about the technique of it and what does it mean to balance. Like even, how do you describe what balance means? Like we're all doing it now, more or less, right? But could you explain, like, how am I balancing? I don't know. There's so many things at work, physically, right, mentally, signals from my brain, muscles, firing up, blood flow. There's so many things going on. You don't have to think about it. It just happens. And so, you know, Zen is primarily about understanding our correct relationship to this life. So correct doesn't mean morally acceptable. It just means appropriate, that's all. Like we all have a correct job to do in life. There are certain situations that call for certain responses than others. And then sometimes the same situation just 10 minutes later calls for a very different response. And that's where thinking is not going to help us in situations like that. So just as, you know, love is not something we can study, right? We cannot put love under a microscope. You can't explain love to someone. We all feel love for someone or something, right? We feel love for a family member, a friend, a spouse, a pet, ourselves, whatever we feel love for, or a cause, or a group of people. But it's not something we can really describe. It's something we experience. So accessing our true nature through practice, through simply doing whatever we're doing wholeheartedly, 100%, not relying on our thinking minds, is what helps our truest sense of love and compassion to arise. One of my favorite sermons the Buddha gave is called the Flower Sermon. So one day, he had a whole lot of his followers in front of a pond. And he reached back into the pond and he pulled up a lotus. And the lotus was dripping with water and mud. And all he did was hold it up. And all the students were looking at him like, what does that mean? And they were like shouting things like, oh, you're talking about impermanence, right? The flower's going to die now. Or you're talking about, we're all beautiful inside, like pretty flowers, right? We're all, I don't know what. And finally, this one guy named Mahakashyapa just looked at the flower and he smiled. Just smiled. And the Buddha said, what can be said, I have said to you. And what cannot be said, I have given to Mahakashyapa. He understood. So no words, no speech, no thinking. No memorizing sutras, quoting scriptures, quoting the Buddha. There's going to be lots of people I'm sure you've met or will meet, people I've met, who like to show you how much they know about everything. And that's great. It's great to know things. And I love to study this stuff, and I do. But that's not going to save us. That's not going to help us.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. For more information about Open Sky Zen, please visit www.openskyzen.com.